Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme.
To be able to walk out of an airport and down onto a boat and into the river is probably one of the more romantic ways you could arrive in any city, especially somewhere as incredibly vibrant and dynamic as London.
Bigger planes and more numerous flights have forced many cities to move their key airport far from the centre. But there remains something special about watching the city from above as you land in what feels like the middle of it. So this week, we ask, what makes a great city airport? Plus, how passengers will soon arrive to the departure gate at London City Airport by boat. We also look back at Hong Kong's old Kai Tak Airport and hear how Lisbon's might have avoided meeting the same fate. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to this week's programme. Now, although it's the smallest of the English capital's five airports, London City Airport is loved for its numerous transport connections, especially for people who live or work to the east of the city. And now, thanks to the new Royal Wharf Pier, designed by Nex Architects, a ferry service will soon be able to drop passengers within a short walk of the departure lounge. Monocle's Nick Manise sat down with Nex's founding director, Alan Dempsey, to find out more.
Rarely is your trip to or from an airport the highlight of your travels. Perhaps you've just touched down after an overnight flight and you're now crammed into the back of a cab, surrounded by luggage. Or maybe you've rushed from the office, briefcase in hand, and are waiting for an express train to an airport on the fringe of the metro area. For the most part, the airport commute won't offer travellers any insight into the metropolis they're in. Whilst you might get to your departure gate quickly, it's difficult to appreciate a city when you're sitting in a carriage, on a train, underground. London City Airport will soon have the antidote to these generic airport commutes, courtesy of an extension to the Thames Clipper ferry service. Soon, you'll be able to tap onto the Clipper with your Oyster or contactless card and ride into the centre of London in under 30 minutes, cruising past Canary Wharf, Tower Bridge and the London Eye. It's been made possible by Nex Architects' new pier, adjacent the airport, that's due for completion in late 2019.
Its primary purpose is to provide a stop and extend the route for the Thames Clipper service that brings it all the way out to the Thames Barrier. And that gets you within 15-20 minutes walk of City Airport. I think what we saw an opportunity in terms of the design was that it went beyond just being a transport stop, if you like, and a connection, to potentially providing some meaningful public realm for the riverside and that part of the river and part of the longer term development of the river frontage out in East London from Millennium Park all the way through back up towards Canary Wharf. And we felt quite strongly there was a real opportunity here to do something quite distinctive and special.
The pier itself is broken into two spans. The first takes you out to a large platform with views to the iconic Thames Barrier. It's a floating public plaza linked to riverside walking and cycling paths. This connects to a second span, an enclosed walkway which extends further onto the river, offering sweeping views of the city and a stop for the Thames Clipper.
The pier is rather long. I think it's going to be the longest pier in London, more or less. It's about 130 metres, and we need to make it that long to get out to the river channel where it's deep enough to deal with the tides. So you have this incredibly long structure that we thought, let's break it up and create a genuine public space on the river, almost like the seaside piers that you often find around the coast of Britain. And here it's not quite seaside, but it is brackish water, right? It's kind of salt water. And I suppose that got us thinking about why not have some kind of public space there that gives you this great opportunity to look down over the Thames Barrier. And then on the other hand, where it switches back and turns for the second span, which goes down to the floating pontoon, you then have this great view back up towards Canary Wharf and the Dome. So it was really trying to pull out the best of the views, the best orientation and aspect, and design the scheme around that.
It's hoped that these views to Canary Wharf's riverside skyline and the use of warm timber, reminiscent of the British seaside, will instantly give travellers a strong sense of arrival in London.
It's an amazing way to travel, actually, if you're a commuter, because it's probably the most low-pressure way to move through London during the day. You have a great seat, you have a bar and a sort of coffee shop and and it actually just glides along. It's kind of amazing. So people who live on the river who are fortunate enough to commute like that, it's certainly something I think many would envy.
For the pier to successfully serve the airport and its East London community, the Clipper network needs to be well connected to the wider city. It's an ambition supported by the Port of London Authority, who want to double current tourist and commuter trips by 2035 and see 20 million yearly passengers travelling along the river.
As I understand it, it will extend the Clipper service as far east as it will go, certainly for the time being, up to the barrier. And it really gives it this opportunity to sort of cover the full stretch of London now. All of these things have to go through a kind of business planning where they understand how many commuters they're likely to have and what's the catchment area. As well as Royal Wharf, which has its 3,000 homes, there's also developments on either side of it that are going to obviously uplift that quite a bit as well. And I think some of the modelling included some modelling of passengers from City Airport, but I think we're quietly confident it would exceed that. The targets aren't that ambitious, and you do have, I think, people really aware that it's a better way to travel, albeit a little slower than the tube perhaps, but certainly there are benefits in terms of the comfort and the lack of stress, if you like.
It's hoped that more and more City Airport passengers will use the ferry as a means of getting to the departure lounge. And with business and tourist destinations lining the Thames, it makes sense to travel to the airport by river, soaking up the last moments of a holiday in London, or even kicking off a day of meetings in one of Europe's financial capitals.
To be able to walk out of an airport and down onto a boat and into the river is probably one of the more romantic ways you could arrive in any city, especially somewhere as incredibly vibrant and dynamic as London. That would be your first journey. You would almost have see all the key sights, you know, on your way in, and you've just arrived. So I think this idea of disembarking, for me, somehow, if I think about it, it would be much more attractive, a journey, if you like, especially as a visitor or as a tourist. It's that kind of classical sort of dérivé through the city. And I think that's the way maybe City Airport might want to talk about it and to say, actually, there is this incredible way into the city that really is quite magical, and day or night, it's probably even better in the evening, actually. The way London lights up on the riverside and these kind of very recognisable landmarks along the way that you will see, I think will be that much more distinctive and memorable.
A report there by Monocle's Nick Manise. Anyone who's seen slightly scary images of airplanes flying past the windows of Hong Kong buildings will recognise Birdie Chu's work. Chu is a Hong Kong-based photographer who spent the earlier half of 1998 snapping images of the city's old Kai Tak Airport, once known for being one of the world's most difficult to fly in and out of. To mark the 20th anniversary of this city airport's demise, Chu has staged a Kai Tak Airport visual retrospective at a local mall in Hong Kong. The exhibition includes 45 photographs and videos of the old Kai Tak and its surrounding neighbourhood, much of which has been erased now by new developments. So Monocle sat down with Chu to find out more about what made Kai Tak so iconic. But first, we hear from some locals and tourists who still fawn over the legendary city airport.
During the 1980s, I worked for Japan Airlines as a flight attendant. So I have a special feeling about Kai Tak Airport because at that time we were flying out of Kai Tak. I think I would do 3 or 4 trips out of Kai Tak to Japan and then to the west coast of the US. Now that we have this airport way out in Chek Lap Kok, at that time at Kai Tak, we don't really realize how convenient it was because I lived in Sha Tin, so I just took a taxi to Kai Tak. But it already was seemed kind of far, but now going to Chek Lap Kok is really, really far. My most vivid memory of flying in and out of Kai Tak was the scary part because it's always like you're landing into the building. And actually, I did have nightmare about it. Yeah, crashing into the buildings. Oh, that would never happen, but it's just like you work so intense, like you would sometimes have all these strange thoughts. So now that Kai Tak is not here anymore, I really miss it. So now I read about this exhibition, so I come back. I live in the States now, so I just come back. I decide to come to see the exhibition to have this feeling back of like the Kaitor era.
There was a medical conference in Singapore, and my head of IT in my department at St. Thomas's Hospital in London, one of the oldest and most famous and the best hospitals in the world, we were giving a couple of papers in Singapore, and she said, by the way, the Hong Kong Sevens are the week after the conference. So I altered my itinerary slightly and flew out from Singapore to Hong Kong. My wife, who's with me, Angela, and our daughter Lucy flew up from London, met us in Hong Kong, and we went to the Sevens. And I had difficulty getting tickets. So, yeah, people may or may not be interested in Hong Kong Sevens. It's the best Sevens, rugby Sevens in the world. So we came in 74, then 75. My wife said, I don't want to go to Hong Kong again because it's such a long way. And I got her a suit made by Sam's. I gave him an advertisement in Nathan Road. He's one of the most famous tailors in Hong Kong, in Kowloon. He's done the King, the Queen, Reagan, name them. He's done the suits for them. And we stayed on Hong Kong Island. And one of the great things was to go to a hotel called the Excelsior, which had a little bar at the top called TOTS, T-O-T-S, Top of the Towns. And there you could sit, nursing a cocktail, slowly, and watch the planes come in. You'd see them from the island in Kowloon come in. You'd see them disappear behind the all the buildings, and then suddenly they'd reappear almost vertical, doing their sharp banking turn and come into land. And it was just one of the greatest experiences. It was something we always did. And of course, we ourselves had to land in that airport. You looked out of the window and there were these buildings, there were people hanging out there washing either side of the plane. Quite amazing picture. And then suddenly you think, there are certain airports that are difficult to land in. Madeira's one, places where St. Helena, where in fact the wind is so bad. You've got to trust the pilot here, because suddenly you've come in, you see all these washing lines, and then the plane tips almost on its side to turn around and come in and to land. Just and quite one of the great experiences of my life, and we had it every year.
Kaitor Airport was closed for 20 years, two decades, so I think most of the Hong Kong people, they are already forgot what Kaitor looks like nowadays. So I would like to let the public, whatever they are, elders or grannies or even teenagers, hopefully this exhibition can introduce different aspects and what kind of experience, especially the landing, unique landing experience for them, because it's a very internationally well-known airport. As I know, that was the 10 most difficult landing airport in the whole world. So Kaitor actually is very internationally well-known, and it's also a legend to us, because as you know, there hasn't been major disasters. Even they flew over our densely populated community. Luckily, we are all safe. When the pilot recognized there is a checkerboard hill, so they have to make a sharp 47 degrees turn. So when we were inside the planes, when that turn happens, we know we are really close to the runway and also very close to the buildings. So because it was so close to the streets and the buildings, so we can watch what kind of dishes they have when they were having dinner at nighttime and what kind of TV program they're watching. So it's a very unique experience and memories. There is a curatorial concept, which is we try to recreate the experience and memory of the old Kaitor. As most of the old Hong Kongers know, that the lobby of Kaitor is mostly in yellow color. So we try to imitate some kind of old signages. And the other thing is, we broadcast some kind of planes landing sound, which is most likely we will try to imitate and bring you back to the old days, which every minute in Kowloon City, the planes will fly over us. So the sound is very familiar to the old community. So that's why when you're watching my photos, you also hear the sound frequently and just like the old days. So this is also one of the curatorial concepts. So when you entered the center stage, you will have a kind of feeling that you're looking at the photos and also you feel like you are at the old Kai Tak again. I think one of the images, maybe the last day of Kai Tak. As you can see, there are tens of thousands of people. They were gathered at the Kai Tak building. They would like to have a last look about this airport. As we can see from this photo, there are planes lining up, and so which means that it's still very busy even on the last day of running. So this photograph, as you can see, there are people busy and planes are lining up and landing. So it's a busy day, even it was the last day of Kai Tak. There are lots of different destinations or locations that I need to take this project. As you can see, I went to Wong Tai Sin, Kun Tong, and even higher up in the mountains, down on the streets of Kowloon City. In all these areas, there are different kinds of experience that when you encountered Kai Tak, especially that you found the close relationship or the very close distance between the plane and the city. So I was amazed by all this kind of stunning and shocking experience. So that's why I was highly motivated and really crazy about the whole thing. The whole concept is just inspiring. So I was just like turning on, and it was the most craziest project of my life so far. Today, the Kai Tak Airport was abandoned and waiting to be developed again because lots of properties, they're trying to rise up again, the whole thing. Already there was a cruise terminal, it's right there, and other land is going to sell. And right now there is a children hospital just established and start running. So the land is reheating again. So I think it's already another phenomenon. I mean, but of course, I'd like to say the most memorial impressions to me is about all the planes flying over your head. So it's no more now.
That was the photographer Birdie Chu on the city's old Kai Tak Airport. Our thanks to Monocle's James Chambers and Karina Tsu for that report. Any traveller who's heading to downtown Milan, make sure to double-check that their ticket says Linate, not Malpensa. The first is a quick and cheap taxi ride away, the latter a long and expensive one. Off to Tokyo, same deal. Haneda is a doddle, Narita a commitment. And Berlin, well, you'll be wanting mini old-fashioned but kind of wonderful Tegel. These city airports are usually diminutive, meaning that curbside to gate is a joyful skip. And that means none of those early check-ins. 30 minutes will do you fine. Sure, you may miss out on shopping mall-sized retail offers or food halls, but you're going to be happier. Oh, a little bit of bad news. Linate has one runway and it needs fixing, so the airport is going to be closed from July to October. Well, at least Malpensa is handy for a jaunt to Lake Como. It's almost time to strap in and fly off, but before we do, let's go to Lisbon. Its airport is one of the few in Europe that's still located close to the heart of the city. For years, various governments have pushed for the Portuguese capital's only landing strip to move elsewhere due to high costs and safety reasons. Plans to relocate it to the south side of the River Tejo have been endlessly abandoned and then revived. Monocle's Carlotta Ribello has the latest on this story.
The debate over a new location for Lisbon's only airport is an old one. Opened in 1942 at the height of the construction boom of Portugal's Estado Novo dictatorial regime, the airport has been struggling for more space since the very beginning. Built barely in what we could call the outskirts of the city, as the capital grew around it, it became obvious that there was an urgent need for expansion. A couple of decades later, in 1969, the government created a department for the new Lisbon Airport, and the first studies and reports started to emerge. The idea of relocating it to the south side of the river has been on the table from the very beginning, but as the dictatorship fell and democracy arrived, the plans were put on hold, the department dismantled and eventually reintegrated in ANA, the entity responsible for managing all aviation-related issues in Portugal. Fast forward to now, nearly half a century after that department was created, and Lisbon's only landing strip still remains in the same place. When concerns over the size of the airport were first raised, an average of 4 million passengers were going through it every year. Today, that number has increased to 29 million, and the airport remains pretty much the same size, other than expanding certain sections here and there and the addition of a smaller terminal for low-cost carriers. Over the years, it's thought that at least 17 different locations have been pondered, studied, and considered for the new airport. Back in 2009, the government at the time settled on the area of Alcochete, across the river and easily accessible from the city via the Vasco da Gama Bridge. With a cost of around 3 billion euros, construction started in late 2010, but the financial crisis hit, forcing the project to a halt once again. By now, we got used to seeing the promise of a new airport as part of every single election campaign. It's been bandied around so much that many don't believe a new airport will ever arrive. And then you have activists who oppose taking the airport out of the city and to the other side of the river. What makes Lisbon such a pleasant place to land in is how you can go from the baggage belt to your hotel or apartment in 10 minutes or less. It is indeed in the middle of this sprawling city. So what's the solution? Well, the current government has revived the debate around the new airport and even signed some agreements to put them in motion. And it seems like their option might actually take off. Instead of completely relocating the current airport elsewhere, it's a mixture between expanding the current one and creating a new, smaller airport south of the river. It won't be built from scratch, though. It's in Montijo, where they will repurpose an old military airbase and turn it into a commercial air terminal. This will be where low-cost and charter flights arriving to Lisbon will land, freeing up space at the current airport for the proposed expansion. At the latest International Air Transport Association Congress, late last year, Portugal's Minister of Planning and Infrastructure said that both airports would be ready to go by 2022, and that the investment would push the number of passengers landing in Lisbon up to 50 million each year. It will be interesting to see how the city will change under these new mammoth projects. It will have to adapt to the rising number of visitors, but also it will require heavy investment in cross-river public transit, which by some way has not been the highlight of Lisbon's transport infrastructure so far. New piers will be created to provide more ferries across the Tejo, and the bridges will be adapted in order to add new bus lanes, and roads will also be added on the south bank. It will take decades until we can look back and decide whether or not this was the right approach. But for now, the idea of keeping a very central airport in place while creating a new one that will also push the city's transit system forward doesn't seem like a bad plan at all. For Monocle, I'm Carlotta Ribello.
And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. This show was produced by Captain Carlotta Ribello, and David Stevens was pushing the trolley of quality offers down the aisle. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, well, here's FM Belfast with Par Avion. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
We were lying down in front of our house in the summertime, in the summertime. I wish I'd had a Caribbean, the Caribbean. I saw a commercial on my television about the Caribbean, and we could go there. Par Avion, Par Avion.
Paravir.